Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by Wiehau Otto Beisheim School of Management, powered by PwC, on the transformation of companies and their culture, from decision makers for decision makers, or from entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs.
Dear listeners, we welcome you to another edition of our podcast series, Leading Corporate Transformation, the WHU or WHU podcast powered by PwC. My name is Martin Glam. I'm a professor of international accounting at the WHU, and I'm one of the hosts of this podcast. With me, as always in this series, is Gori von Hirschhausen from PwC, who co-hosts these podcasts. Gori?
Hello, listeners. Very well to be back. So thanks for tuning in. My name is Gori von Hirschhausen. I'm leading our management consulting practice. My job as a consultant is to support companies on their business transformation journey. And we like to say from strategy through execution is what we do. And my focus is to digitize the enabling functions like finance. And this is why my focus for our talk today is to understand how a prominent grown-up company developed itself over the last 10 years. This brings me to our guest today. We are very honored and pleased to have Sebastian, CFO of Westwing, with us today. Sebastian, welcome to our podcast. Sebastian, would you be so kind to introduce yourself and Westwing to all our listeners who might not have heard about Westwing yet?
Yes, so maybe I start first with myself, so thank you very much. My name is Sebastian Säuberlich, I'm 43 years old. I studied in Karlsruhe, then started my career as a consultant at Bain & Company. During that time, I had the opportunity to do an MBA at INSEAD, before then joining a small family business that I helped turning around for 2 years. Then I had a stopover in mid-cap private equity at Deutsche Private Equity, a growth-focused investor. Before I finally joined Westwing in 2014, did several roles. I started as an MD for a daily themes business in Germany, then moved on and helped the private label business, or Westwing Collection, as we call it now, business to develop. And since 3 years, I'm in finance now, and the last 2 years as a group CFO. And yeah, privately, I'm married, have 3 kids, and when the time allows, try to play a bit of basketball here and there. Yeah, for those that don't know Westwing, we're the inspirational home and living e-commerce business in Europe. So basically, we sell through 2 channels. On the one hand, we have our daily themes. On the other hand, we have a permanent assortment. And we sell home and living products on a daily basis to our customers. We have a very high loyalty of the business model. I guess we come to that also later. And yeah, see ourselves basically as a shoppable magazine. So not just a pure shop, but like we want to inspire and entertain our customers and do that with the webpage we have and all the products that we sell.
Sebastian, why would people buy furniture online? I mean, you already spoke about the concept of a shoppable magazine and you used the word inspirational. So what makes you inspirational and what makes you a magazine rather than just a web page on which I can look at, you know, furniture and think, you know, whether I want to buy this couch or the other?
Yeah. So I think that's driven by the 2 business models or business channels that we have. So one, the daily themes. And I think that is basically what drives the inspiration, because we curate and select on a daily basis very good product offering for our customers, and it's basically available only 4 days. So it's a new thing to find out every day. So that is one of the key reasons people quite often visit our page, because there's something to explore and something new every day. I think our customers trust us and in the way we curate and pre-select also the offering. So it's not like a web page where you can find millions of products and you have to find your way, but we kind of pre-select and curate that product that our customers hopefully love and then also sometimes buy. Yeah.
Okay.
Why should you buy home and living products online? I think it's very convenient, right? So you don't have to drive hours to a shopping mall and spend the time waiting to get in, to get out, to pay. But you can, it's a very, very cool experience, I think. to buy online. And I think we have also over the last 10 years very much worked on the customer experience, that it kind of this delivery is better, our packaging is better, and all these things have improved massively. So it should by now be a very comfortable experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. As you say, you have a high customer retention rate, high loyalty. So it seems that with your daily offerings, generally with the offerings, you're very, very successful, which also means that you seem to know your customers very well, right? So because otherwise, the idea of giving them every day that might interest them doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we know a lot about our customers, but I think it's not only knowing about them. It's also, I think, trying to set kind of the tone or set the standards of what we can sell. And that's, I think, why we have a very strong creative focus, and our creative people very much invest a lot of time. Okay, what are the trends? What are the things people we think they want to have? And also sometimes they don't know that in the morning what they want to buy. So it's I think our style and creative experience and focus that helps us a lot in ensuring that these offerings kind of fit to our customers and also are not getting boring, but are entertaining and exciting every day.
Looking at the size of the business in terms of revenue, how big is Westwing?
In 2021, unaudited financials, but we gave a kind of a trading update. We did 522 million in revenues and we grew 21%.
That's impressive. So talking about growth, I mean, how is the correlation with the pandemic, the situation that people were shopping from home? What was the impact on your business model?
Yeah, I think there was a strong impact that we saw. So I think I can describe it with going through phases. I think there was early days like March 2020, where basically lockdown started and so on. And the level of uncertainty and insecurity was very high. We were basically preparing for a downturn scenario, right? We were saying, okay, what cost can we maybe cut? How can we save cash? How do we deal with the situation? And then we started to realize that actually we are like benefiting from the situation. So kind of the order volumes went up, customer acquisition numbers went up steadily, and we had a very, very strong April and May. And we saw kind of, there was a fast forward of e-commerce penetration. But I think home and living e-commerce penetration is still low, but was much lower before COVID than it is now. But I think it took a 2 to 3 year acceleration, and kind of all these things moved online in a very short time frame. So I think that helped us, obviously, because with size in our business model also comes profitability. I mean, we were like barely profitable before this, slightly negative on adjusted EBITDA, and in 2020 for the first time we had double digit adjusted EBITDA. So kind of the size helped us tremendously in realizing economies of scale, utilizing our logistics network better, and then kind of being much more profitable than we have been before. But obviously that was something we always planned, but seeing it then in reality and that was super good for us and gave us the confidence that we have the right business model if we have the right size to be very profitable. Yeah.
So, but it stayed on the same size?
No. And so basically, I think we had, as I said, very strong Q2 then. And then over the summer, it slowed down a bit. I mean, there was also then restrictions lifting, but it was still strong. And then we saw a very, very strong Q4 2020 and Q1 2021. So there, I think, I mean, we do the majority of our sales in the DACH region. There was like a heavy lockdown. People still, I think, had a lot of money they could spend. And so it continued. And I think even Q4 2020, Q1 2021 were much stronger. And then from Q2 2021, it started to slow down a bit. So Q2 was still strong. Then summer was even like stronger summer seasonality than we usually see. And also Q4 was in terms of relative growth, actually it was negative on GMV. So it was slowing down. But what we can see kind of the general change or demand shift, that is there to stay, right? And now we are fluctuating around that a bit. And obviously after a year of 2020 with 60% growth, we did also not expect to add another year with 60% growth. So we're happy with the 21. But also we see it now And I think you see that in a lot of e-commerce companies, that kind of the comparables of the last year are very high, especially the first half year. And so it will be tougher to put growth on this. But what we believe is that the general trend is fully intact. And now we're fluctuating around it a bit.
Okay, cool. But looking at the moment, what are the biggest challenges for Westwing at the moment then?
I think currently what are the challenges? I think we see temporal challenges from the supply chains. We see that our suppliers are increasing their lead times. And so the lead time volatility is quite high. That means we have to buffer this with more stock. And also demand volatility is quite high. I mean, we went into the COVID phase and kind of demand exploded somehow. And now it's going back. And to predicting that is not that easy. So kind of that's a challenge for us. And managing then the inflow of goods and keeping kind of track of everything. And at the same time, container cost increased drastically. That's also something you can read in the press. And that's something, I mean, for us, it was always a small expense and we have managed more or less like a sea product, right? There was not much attention on buying sea freight rates because it was like a commodity. Yeah. Unfortunately, this commodity got 5 times more expensive over the last months. So it's now a bigger topic. But first of all, it's costing us profitability. We try to pass on some of that, but we can't pass on all. And we hope that this will relax over the next year. So for me, that's like temporal challenges that will impact our bottom line results, but that don't impact our long-term vision or our long-term ability to be very profitable. And I think another big challenge that everyone has in the market is that I see the war for talent, how I think it was called a couple of years ago, when I think it was not a war yet, but now it really became one. So kind of hiring and retaining the right talent, I think that is a challenge because also given the corona situation and now the new working policies, basically the job market also is now more global competition than a local one. And people are actually also looking everywhere. So it's tougher. And that's also one of the reasons we invested heavily into our HR and also people development over the last year. And I think that's something that's also there to stay. And it's not corona related, but that was kind of also kind of maybe starting or tipping point in the change. So that will be a challenge for the next years, yes.
Mm-hmm. Sebastian, you are a e-commerce company, that's for sure, and you have experienced tremendous growth over the last 2 years. It's almost doubled your revenues over the last 2 years. At the same time, while you have this platform business, behind it is, of course, supply chain and logistics that you need to manage. How do you scale this in such a short time? And looking forward, you have communicated that you want to achieve revenues of about 1 billion. How can you scale the operations behind the platform?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's most interesting for those processes where you don't have the economies of scale. So I think if you talk about my back office, I'm glad we basically do more of the same. So kind of the number of purchase orders didn't significantly increase, but the volume per purchase order. But right, like for me in the admin workload has not drastically increased, but I think we did a great job in scaling our logistics. I mean, we had to double volumes from 1 month to the other, like kind of. And I think, we did a good job there. And I think one advantage is we were prepared because for us, usually Q4, is seasonally the strongest quarter. And then we have the Black Friday week where we kind of have probably 4 or 5 times the revenue of a normal week. So that skills we have developed over the last years, like scaling up the operations for a short-term peak, we could use them quite well. We were lucky that then this wasn't the 1 week peak or the demand kept coming in. So we had to keep that capacity, but we were like experienced to scale it up. We were also, I think, lucky that we had enough capacity in our warehouses to deal with the growth. So we invested into a new warehouse, I think in 2019, that helped us now because we had the space, we had the flexibility to do that. And that's also something when we think going forward, what we have to invest into is again, more capacity in our supply chain or in our distribution network, to be able to also then take the next level of growth and be prepared. I mean, this time I think we were, you can say we were kind of lucky because we had this spare capacity, but we want to now also develop the next warehouses to be then able to also deliver the 1 billion you mentioned. And I think another element that helps us is also that with our daily themes business, that's a pure cross-docking business or mostly cross-docking. So there you need the handling capacity, but you don't need the storage capacity. So we could grow also with the existing infrastructure quite well by just adding a second shift or even very high times adding a third shift. But that's super good. Huh?
So Sebastian, for the non-expert in your business, what is a cross-docking business?
Okay, yeah, sorry. It's basically we collect the orders from our customers for a period of 4 days. Let's say that's a typical sales campaign. And then we place this order with the supplier. And then he sends basically all the customers' orders in one big bulk to our warehouse. And we don't take them in stock and then resend them, but we just cross-dock. So kind of we immediately send it out again, but in smaller packages and dedicated to each customer. So and by that, you only need kind of handling space, but not big storage space, even to grow significantly your business.
Good. Changing track a little bit, but kind of staying with supply side and logistics. Online shopping does not always have a good reputation, at least for sustainability, with high transportation costs, and at least for some companies that is quite well known, high rates of products that are returned. Is this a problem for Westwing too?
Obviously, our return rates are much, much lower than in fashion. So I think it is something we always will offer to our customers because we want to make them happy. And of course, sometimes there's things you cannot plan, or then you don't like the color, or you don't like the fit of anything. So I think we always will have returns, and we should be also enabling the returns. But at the same time, we should work against that to minimize that as much as possible. Not only due to the economic impact, but also or the environmental and the economic impact. So because also return for us is usually not a profitable order at the end. And that's also where we invest. So better pictures, better descriptions, and so on. And that helps reducing return rates. But I think there will always be returns. Yeah.
Maybe that's a good also point in time in our discussion to maybe switch to your CFO role. So Sebastian, how is it to be the CFO of Westwing? What keeps you awake at night?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's a super exciting role because we are like very, very, as you said, highly growing business with also some complexity. I mean, we're operating in 11 European markets. We have a significant number of legal entities we have to manage and to maintain. So I think it's for sure not a boring job. So it's good. And what keeps me awake, I think during night, I mean, I'm always kind of worried is the wrong word, but I think I'm always like looking, okay, are we developing in the direction we wanted? Are our margins intact? I think margin is a key focus of our work, so kind of the retail margins. Because we have seen also in the past we had low contribution margins, and that's not really an attractive business, because even if you grow, kind of not much falls through to your bottom line. So we really focus on high contribution margins because that allow us either to be more profitable or to spend more money on marketing or technology or other areas. So I think margin is always kind of the worry, and always the top line is always, as a retailer, the worry number one, because the consumer is not predictable all the time. So it's every day also important for us to see where we end up.
I mean, being a CFO and coming from the private equity background and from the consulting, how is it in such a very creative and, let's say, marketing savvy environment? Are you the bad cop when it comes to taking decisions in the company?
I wouldn't say I'm the bad cop, but I think I'm sometimes the conscience. How do you say, the economical consciousness or something of the business? So I try to focus all the creativity in a way that is A, driving results, and B, also what we can afford, right? That's why we have a kind of strict budgeting processes where we allocate the resources to where we think this will add the most value for the business. And it's kind of something we do, CEO, CFO together. And once we have that, kind of we try to stick to it. And obviously on the way we get smarter, we make trade-offs, we make changes. But I think we always have kind of a, yeah, some boundaries that are guiding our decisions throughout the year, and that helps. And but it's also something that we have developed last year and the year before. We kind of changed the budget basically on a monthly basis because we were surprised by some things, and some things worked out, some things were not working. So kind of we're making then agile shifts. But I think, yeah, our creative people work very well together kind of with the business people, and I think they know that not everything can be financed, but we also know that they often have very good ideas, and we should look how we can finance it, because it in the long term will pay off for the customer. Yeah.
So if I may jump in, you just used the word agile, and obviously your business is very fast anyways. You have these daily changes in your set of offers and the products you do and so on. So what are the metrics you use to monitor such a type of business and that you use to steer that kind of business? I assume that you use probably in your daily business a lot of non-financial metrics. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, I think there are, like, first of all, some metrics that we also report to the outside that obviously are also very important for us to steer. And when we look at our non-financial KPIs, and to a certain degree also financial, but they're non-P&L financial KPIs, let me call it that way. So we look at our Westwing collection share. That is basically giving us an indication of how much of our sales or GMV we do. GMV is gross merchandise value, basically the order entry of our business. So we see how much we do with our own products, and we have a strategic target of bringing this to 50%. And then so we can see if we track on plan or not. Then obviously we look at, even daily, we look at our GMV, so what comes in across the different countries, the different channels. We look at orders, average order value, because that kind of is also an indication for interest, but AOV also for profitability. We look at our customers, so how many active customers do we have? Active customer defined as a customer for that did a purchase in the last 12 months. We look at their orders and GMV. We look at mobile visits, app visits, and all these things. So kind of, that's kind of high level, but then we also look at in each individual business at much, much more KPIs, right? Like in supply chain, they look at availability. In our daily themes, we look into the newsletter opening rates, for example, to see how attractive was this newsletter, what can we do better with the next. So kind of there are tons of data we look into, but also, as you said, as our business, especially the daily themes, is kind of changing quite frequently, there's also only a certain, so some data is not really helpful. So we don't look into individual products, the daily themes, how they perform, and then try to kind of optimize this, because we want to be more, like, it should be more entertaining. And if you have the same white glass or white a cup of tea or whatever that sells very well, I mean, data would tell you, bring it online every day, but that would then fast be boring. So kind of it's also kind of the thing, making sure that we also allow this creative and inspirational input like we discussed before, and not only look at data.
I mean, when you talk about the way how you analyze the performance of the business KPIs, you look at, me coming from finance, I always know when it comes to data, it often also becomes messy. What do I mean by this? It becomes, of course, a lot of, let's say, data typing and consolidating work. So my question, Sebastian, how digitized is the back office of finance within your organization?
Yeah. So if we think about, I mean, first of all, the question of the data, I think we have decided very early on to have a central data warehouse. So that is super helpful because it consolidates basically all the data from different systems into one infrastructure that is basically for kind of expert users openly available. So kind of all our departments can collect and do their analysis that they need. There are obviously also predefined definitions, predefined analysis in the data warehouse, but there's also a lot of flexibility. So I can access logistics data in very detail if I want. I can access sales data. So kind of that's super helpful. And I think we did a very good job in the beginning to once define the infrastructure well, and then kind of it's growing with the business. It's super helpful. But that's mainly for non-financial KPIs, right? So kind of all the business things. But for a retailer, I mean, most of the financial KPIs are driven from your top line and the product profitability. So kind of it has most of what we need. In terms of how digitized are we in finance, I think there's also two things to separate. So I think one on the, so to say, accounts receivable side or everything that's sales, that's fully automized, right? We get this from our pre-systems. The documents are flowing into our ERP. So that's kind of, no one is really touching that. But then we have the other side, it's our accounts payable. And there I would say we are still like bookkeeping, like a traditional small, medium enterprise. So we are not very automated, but that's kind of on the roadmap for the next years. But first, we want to move to the new ERP system. I think we might talk about that later. Right. So, and before that, we are not investing into automation or OCR or any of these things, because we believe let's wait till we have the new system and then these things make sense. But yeah, I think you would probably be surprised how manual we are still in some processes.
But you were mentioning the ERP, and let's already touch this one. Looking at your ERP implementation, can you tell us a little bit about where you are on the journey and what the challenges are and what you are expecting from the implementation?
Yes, I mean, we have decided to upgrade our ERP. So we are working currently with Navision, and we're now moving on to Business Central, what is basically kind of both Microsoft products. So it's a follow up, but we haven't changed like the version for quite a while. So we're like accelerating that. And we decided this a couple of years back because we see, okay, it's getting more and more data is more complex in terms of VAT setups. That's kind of all needs to be solved. So we said, okay, let's start greenfield and basically restart this, the whole process. And that's what we did. And we decided to start with one smaller country that actually went live beginning of 2021. That was, I think, also a very good idea to take like one pilot country that is not so complex in terms and really get going, right? Because, I mean, for 11 countries, markets, if you want to write the requirement book, you can also spend a couple of years, and by then the business has changed a lot. And we try to also be agile here, but it's not as easy as in our other software developments, because at the end it needs to work. So we did one country, Netherlands, that worked well. And now we're in the middle of implementing Germany. So that's our biggest entity that's hopefully happening this year. And maybe some lessons learned. I think we, in the beginning, underestimated the complexity and the time and the workload it has, right? We just thought we're just bringing everything together from the pre-systems. It's anyway there, so it shouldn't be a lot of work, but it is. So you have to be really focused on this. You have resources that drive this. It's not enough if I do it like with 10% of my time or anything. Second thing, I think also very important, you need to know what you want in the beginning. So because there are levels, like you can automize a lot, you can automize little, customize a lot, you can integrate a lot or not. So you really have to know, okay, what are the processes you want to be fully integrated with your systems? What are the ones where you can actually work with manual steps? So because if you don't know that, or then kind of you end up in a disaster. And also the hard thing is, I think everybody always like aims for 100% full automation, but then forgets on the way, is the trade-off worth it, right? Like, I don't want to write like, I don't know, 2 weeks of code for something that takes an accountant 30 minutes a month, right? So, yeah. Kind of the things you have to manage in the process, that you get the right balance of these things. You also don't want to have a new system that's actually nobody's liking. So it needs to be a trade-off. Yeah. And I think last but not least, testing, also keeping a lot of capacity for testing, And data migration, that's also something we learned and underestimated in the beginning. No?
Gori and Sebastian, if you allow, I would like to take our discussion a little bit on another track now and look at the stock market and the stock market performance of your shares. You did an IPO in 2018 in September, selling the shares for 26 euros. Then the shares lost almost 90% of their value, rose very strongly again, with a high then very strongly in with a high in May 2021 at 54 euros. However, they have gone down again to roughly 20 euros. So again, somewhat under the emission price. How can you explain this dramatic roller coaster of share price? I'm sure your investors must have very good nerves, but how come that quite obviously investor expectations have changed so profoundly, over such relatively short periods of time?
Yeah. I think very difficult to explain, to be honest. Like if I look, and you also from the academic view of kind of discounted future cash flows and interest rates, basically, right? I don't think that these things so fundamentally change on the way. So, I mean, I think currently, and I can also come back to our story, but also currently you see the volatility in the stock markets is, from my point, just crazy. I think today Delivery Hero lost, 25% in market cap by providing a different outlook than the market expected, but not significantly different. I mean, I don't know, Snap and Meta earning calls also kind of sent the stock down 25% and the other one up 47% or something. So I think volatility is just crazy and it's not related to the expectations of the business to the degree I would guess. So that's one. But that's just recent volatility. If we come to our stock price, I think when we started on the stock exchange 2018, I think overall the multiples were still very high and we got quite a high multiple for the business. And I think what happened then in 2019 was that the IPO expectations were not fully fulfilled. So we were growing slower, profitability was slightly lower. And I think that started then into people losing a bit, I don't want to call it trust, but maybe trust into the stock and also into the outlook, right? And I think then the market, in my view, again, overreacted because I think at the 2 euros you were mentioning, we were trading below cash, right? So maybe also a bit an overreaction, but also it's just like it depends a bit on who's selling, who's buying and so on. And then clearly during COVID, people realized, I think even before that, what I always want to tell. So I think Q1 2020, without any COVID, we already had good results, growing stronger again, showing higher profitability. So I think that's kind of when it started to stabilize. And then obviously we had the Corona tailwinds that kind of carried forward or moved forward the e-commerce penetration by a couple of years and also our business. Interestingly, and then I think the market kind of overreacted to the top by bringing us kind of to a multiple of 1.8 that's in future sales. So I think that's also quite high. And then I think, there was a sector rotation. So everyone wanted to get out of these e-commerce or stocks Corona winners, and now we're back to, let's say, roughly IPO value. And that is, I think, we're the much better company than at IPO. We have proven that we can be profitable. We're much bigger in size. We're ahead of the IPO plan, so to say. That's then, again, I also think a bit strange. And also our expectations and also the expectations we have communicated have not changed as drastically as the stock price did. But then if you look at the full market, everybody, I think we're just like in line with that sector of the market.
Well, it's in any case, it's a very, very interesting development and very traumatic in a way. Looking back at the beginning of your company, West Wing was funded from early on, partly by Rocket Internet. Rocket Internet then sold out. All of what we're talking about now is communicated. It's public knowledge, and they sold most of their shares, only then to reinvest later in 2019 when it was announced that they again held something like 25% of your shares. So, could you tell us something about what is behind these moves of Rocket Internet going in and out, and about your current relationship to Rocket Internet?
Yeah, so I think we're not discussing investment strategies and decisions with our investors. So we talk mostly with them about the business. So I cannot answer that. Or if I would, I had to speculate. So I do that. But what I can say that we are super happy that having this shareholder back, because he's a very experienced e-commerce investor. He believes obviously in the long-term potential of our company and probably saw a very attractive opportunity to invest at 2019 when we were trading at a very low valuation. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think. Yeah. In terms of, I think that the role, I think it's like any of the other bigger shareholders that we are having. So we are communicating like with our IR department frequently with our investors, but basically that's it. Otherwise, we're a public markets company.
I mean, West Wing is such an interesting company, and I'm sure we can talk for many more hours about West Wing. Nevertheless, our listeners are also very, very interested in the person behind the role, Sebastian. So it would be also interesting to learn a little bit about yourself and how you manage. So please tell us a little bit about your management and or your leadership style. How do you lead? How do you delegate? What motivates you?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's always an interesting topic. I think, I try to, how I would describe my leadership style is I think that my job is to enable my direct reports and my teams to do their best possible job. And that often means by trying to kind of keep away some of the unnecessary work. So I try like to protect them that they can really focus on the targets and the things we have agreed. Sometimes I fail also at this, but I think that's kind of number one, kind of having clear accountabilities and enable people to deliver on those and then keeping their backs free so that they can actually do that. Also, I think by now in my role, I have quite a senior and experienced team. So that's super helpful because you don't have to micromanage, right? That's something I still probably sometimes tend to do on some topics, and my direct reports would probably say so, but I try to avoid and really try to focus on the results with them and helping them achieving them and try to be open for discussions and to be a sparring partner and also to help if they need support in terms of talking to other departments, then obviously sometimes I can be of help. Yeah.
I mean, looking back the years with West Wing, is there something where you would say, I would do this different now with all the knowledge that I have? Is there something where you would say, that's a great advice for younger people if they take on a career to become CFO of such a great company like West Wing?
Yeah, I mean, they're for sure. I mean, every year there are things we would be doing differently. And I think, I mean, some of the learnings everyone has to do on his own. But I think overall, what I have learned, like also being a public market CFO is probably what helps is under promise and over deliver, right? Like,
yeah.
I think we are like very honest and sometimes also too optimistic in what we think. And that's not really valued by the public markets, I think. So that's something I would probably... So kind of no one is kind of sad if you positively surprise, right? So
yeah.
That's something I had, and I'm still learning, I guess. So, but I would probably do a bit differently. Other than that, I think a lot of things you learn on the way, what you could be doing differently, and you should be doing better next time.
Yeah, I mean, you were with a private equity company. You have been in strategy consulting. Is there something where you say, this is something I really brought from this experience to West Wing?
Yes, I think, I mean, every step, I think, of my career or life forms you as a person and gives you experiences that you can use. But I think, yes, management consulting, especially as a start, I think is super good because you learn, you have a very steep learning curve. You get exposed to a lot of businesses and different business problems. That's super helpful to get a wider understanding, right? You're not only working usually in one industry or on one topic, but you get a lot of things to think about and to help. Then obviously, I think it strengthened my analytical toolkit and built the foundations of that and frameworks that you can use. So I enjoyed very much the life as a management consultant. I didn't want to do it forever, but I think I learned a lot of valuable things. And also kind of service mentality helps. You see yourself as a service provider, and that's also helpful. And in PE, I think also you learn different things. What I learned there is what brought it clearly, I think that you have to be, as an investor, you have to be in the right market. Competitive position is super important, because if you're in the wrong market, even the best management team will probably not help you. But also, second point, having a great management team is also super important. And this alignment, I think the alignment between shareholder and management of where you want to go and how to get there is super important, because then everybody can do his work. If you have misalignment here, you always kind of get into these discussions, and that's kind of not very productive. And I think in general, as an investor, you have to be patient. I mean, there are times, I mean, look at e-commerce. There were times nobody wanted to own e-commerce stocks. There were times when everybody wanted to own e-commerce stocks, and now maybe we're in the middle of that, but you have to be patient, right? You can't, you shouldn't be selling when it's not on vogue to sell.
Yeah. It is a tradition in this podcast that towards the end, we always ask our guest whether he or she has a book recommendation for our listeners. Now, Sebastian, I don't know whether you're a book person, but do you have something that you would like to recommend to our
listeners? Yes, absolutely. No, I think I try to be a book person. Unfortunately, like, time is limited, but maybe I have two things. So one is the last book I read. That's Amazon Unbound. I think that's super interesting to see how Jeff Bezos is building this empire. So I think lots of valuable learnings for how to run a company, but also I think entertaining and exciting to read, not too boring. So that's cool. And the other one is a book I read. I actually don't read. I had the audiobook, but that is recommended to me by almost every of our investors. So I think for every CFO out there, investors want you to read this book. It's from William and Thorndike, The Outsiders, and it's about capital allocation and how 8 unconventional CEOs kind of had radical blueprint for success by thinking about capital allocation in a new way. So they're all buying back shares and making the earnings per share go up.
That sounds like a good reading, right?
Indeed. Sounds very interesting. Cory, Sebastian, we thank you very, very, very much for this interesting conversation and for this insights into West Wing, a young and very strongly growing company. You know, in some of our past podcasts, we have visited established companies with long histories. This time we were at a very young company. And that was also very, very interesting to look at. We thank you, dear listeners, also for your interest in this podcast. And we hope you enjoyed it. And we very much hope to meet with you again in the near future when we again present a new leading transformation podcast. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Thank you also from my side for having me. And I hope everyone enjoyed this conversation. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Sebastian.
That was Leading Corporate Transformation, the podcast by VHU Autobahnsheim School of Management, powered by PwC. Editorial team, Marvin Schuna and Simon Gerlach.